Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Robert Moore, writer, activist, philosopher, and we're talking about his latest book, In Trees, An Exploration. Robert, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Hey, Mark. Thanks so much for having me.
I just want to say for the benefit of the audience that this is an important and fascinating book. And there's a lot of well-thought-out, nuanced writing, and I can't possibly, neither of us can possibly do justice to it in a short show. But if you want to, the only thing I can recommend is that you buy the book and read it, actually read it. Robert, were you always fascinated by trees since a young age?
I think I always loved trees. I always had a close relationship with them. I grew up in, you know, what they call a leafy little suburb in Illinois, and we can, you know, unpack that term later if you like, but I'm surrounded by trees, and I love to climb trees, and I love sitting in their shade and reading, and I think, you know, as I write in the book, I was raised with almost a kind of religious reverence for them. It didn't feel religious at the time because it was kind of omnipresent, and it was totally naturalized. But I saw them as kind of saints. You know, they were the saints of my world. They gave us fresh air to breathe and cool shade, and you know, they were nonviolent and peaceful and patient. And so I've always had a kind of reverence for trees. But the fascination part didn't really kick in till much later, until I was an adult and I moved here to British Columbia.
That'll do it for you.
Yeah, I think living in a forest, suddenly you're just looking at them all day long, and you start to think, you know, deeper thoughts about what a tree is, what a tree means, and how it's sort of woven itself into our lives.
Especially as I've gotten older in the last several decades, you know, you can't just pass a tree by. You actually, you know, you start to develop fondness for certain trees and interest in the way that, you know, that they exist and behave. What I love about this book is everything is tree related. Even the table of contents is diagrammed as a tree. And I love the fact that the prologue is the sky and the epilogue is soil. And you really push the tree thing to the nth degree, which I really appreciate.
Well, you know, it's funny you point that out about the table of contents, because a lot of people miss that. That isn't just sort of a visual gimmick. The book is actually structured that way. And I'm embarrassed to admit, years playing with that structure. I have a sort of fondness for people like John McPhee, who play with structure in original ways. And so the idea was that you could read the book, you could start at any one of those four branches, and you could read your way down that sort of family tree. Until you get to the single trunk. And it's a sort of reverse choose-your-own-adventure style. And in fact, at one point, for a long time, I had 8 prologues in addition to the 4 opening chapters, which was, I could tell you, hell to make work. And eventually my editor mercifully just pruned them all away.
Whoa. You used the P word. I loved it.
too many prologues. It's too exhausting. But we tried to keep that structure in part because what I'm trying to impart is what I call tree thinking.
It's
a different way of seeing the world that's not just linear, that's not unilinear, it's branchy. And I think we do this sometimes, we understand it when it comes to family trees or the evolutionary tree of life, but most of the time it's really hard for us to break out of that more narrow mode of thought, especially when it comes to books, because books by their very nature are single line. You know, you turn from one page to the next. It's a single narrative line. Well, unless you're reading a choose your own adventure book or looking at a hypertext fiction online or something, you know, it's like people don't do very much anymore. We don't think of narratives as being nonlinear, but I'm trying to play with that in a subtle and hopefully not too irritating way.
This book really traces your evolution from being fascinated by trees, being in trees, to really seriously consider how to live in relationship to nature like a tree, and in a deep way, a sense that may have sounded frivolous, but I didn't mean it to. And so just the flow of the book is very tree-like.
Yeah, I think that's a phrase I use, and it's sort of deliberately provocative to try to think like a tree, and also to think about trees. And I think those two things actually go hand in hand. I think the people who think a lot about trees and who love trees also tend to develop that arborescent shape of thought. It just seems to happen, and I'm not totally sure how, but I think part of it is because we evolve, mentally. I mean, not sort of on the biological level, but maybe that as well, to fit the environments in which we live, and the environment that a lot of us live in nowadays is the internet. You know, that's where we spend most of our days is online, and in that environment, you're basically in two shapes of thought. One is very, very narrow, right? You're just in these sort of narrow little narrative chambers online. I mean, you're on social media, or you're reading little news stories. They're very tight and narrow, and I think it creates a narrowness of mind that's really unhealthy. And I think a lot of us can feel that kind of happening to ourselves. And the other is really sprawling and chaotic. It's what Deleuze and Guattari called the rhizome. You know, it has no center and it has no edges. That's what it feels like to be on the internet. You're just sort of lost in this wilderness. And what I find so beautiful about trees is it's a shape of being, a way of being, really, that you know, marries the manyness and oneness in a really elegant form. So it shows, for example, how all living beings can be highly diverse, but we can also all be deeply related. And that's a powerful realization when you apply it to many parts of your life. I mean, tree thinking is actually a term I found in evolutionary biology. An evolutionary biologist named Robert J. O'Hara coined it. And I think when you start applying it to other things, it starts to wake you up, and you start to see the way that everything is both many and one.
It's amazing the stages of tree thinking that you go through in this book. I mean, early on, I think it's your husband had a stroke, and you started thinking about the brain as a tree, or the similarities between the structure of the brain and the structure of a tree.
Yeah, I mean, that actually, funnily enough, that realization came even earlier. It's true. In 2019, my husband did have a stroke, and it was a terrifying thing. It happened in the middle of the night, and you know, he woke up, he couldn't stand. One whole side of his body was numb for a number of days, and he eventually recovered all of his powers, but there was a period of time there where it was very touch and go, and so we started becoming kind of obsessed with neuroscience and reading everything we could, and especially following the doctor's orders, which was do as much stuff as you can. You know, they say use it or lose it is what they keep telling stroke patients. But it reminded me that years earlier, I had gone and interviewed a neuroscientist named Jeff Lichtman at Harvard. This is when I was researching my first book on trails, because I wanted to talk to him about neural pathways. And I went into his office. He's a fascinating scientist. He creates what are called brain bows. So he'll take mouse brains and he'll shave them into micron thick slices. It's like a tiny meat slicer, basically. And then he scans them into a computer and he maps these mouse brains. And one of the things that he was finding is that our brains are actually really inelegant. Our neurons are often much longer, as much as 40% longer than they need to be to get from point A to point B. And I asked him, why is that? You know, it seems really strange to me, because a pathway, as you know, if you ever go hiking or even just walk across a park, a pathway will eventually straighten out, because people will shave off the side curves. You know, people like to take the path of
But your brain does not do that.
No, the brain will not do that. And it will stay crooked. And I said, why is that? And he said, well, it's not really a pathway. Pathway is the wrong metaphor. It's really much more like a tree branch. And a tree branch can be incredibly gnarled, incredibly crooked, but as long as it reaches that patch of light, it survives. And he said, a lot of life is like that. You know, we like to think that everything is optimizing and becoming perfect over time. It's not. A lot of it is kind of locked in place, and that's okay. You know, in fact, there's a certain beauty in that. It's kind of what gives things character and texture, and even the course of our lives, in a sense, are like that. They're gnarled. You can't go back and change the past, but that's all right. You need to learn to embrace that sort of hard wisdom.
But you also seem to warn people about growing more gnarled as you get old, and gnarled doesn't necessarily have to be a good thing.
I think I would say I would warn us of becoming over pruned as we get old. I think gnarling is inevitable. I don't think you can avoid it. Whether that's your fingers becoming arthritic or your life having all these twists and turns that you can't go back and change. What neuroscientists taught me is that the challenge of growing old is to stay branchy. It's really basically on a biological level, on a neural level. When you're born, you have the most neurons you'll ever have. You have the most neural connections you'll ever have. And over your life, you're pruning those neural connections away. That's actually the term that neuroscientists use. They call it blossoming and pruning. And so at first, that's a really good thing because that's how you make a clear picture of the world. That's how a sense of elegance and really wisdom emerges out of the chaos of childhood. You know, you're just overconnected when you're a kid and you have too many thoughts and too many impressions and can't really put it all together. And as you learn to do things, what you're learning to do is unlearning how to do things the wrong way and unlearning some of the false beliefs or false practices that will lead you astray. But over time, it can start to get you in trouble. And that's what Lichtman told me. You know, he said, I'm at this point, I'm in my 70s, and I've become such a hardwired person. My kids don't even want to talk to me anymore because they already know what I'm going to say. You know, I've pruned away all the surprising aspects of my personality. But then he said, I talked to him again 10 years later for this book, and he said, but there is one thing that's interesting, which is I was just promoted to a new position, which I didn't want. I was the dean of science at Harvard. And now in this new position, I'm having all these new ideas, and I'm trying all these new things, and I'm pissing everyone off, and it's great. You know, I'm branchy again. So it is possible to stay branchy, but it kind of takes work, and I think it takes pushing yourself out of your comfort zone.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Robert Moore, writer, activist, philosopher, and we're talking about his latest book, In Trees, An Exploration. There's so many great points in this book. One of them is I loved how you had to learn or relearn how to climb a tree. And you learned from Ben Atkinson in Britain about, what did you learn? It seems like I would be very fearful of falling at my age, especially. But how did you overcome that fear?
Well, it's funny. I actually took a pretty strange route to it. I had tried to climb a tree as an adult. I went and tried to climb this tree by the seaside where I live, and I had a sort of panic attack. You know, I had a bout of basically vertigo. I got maybe 10 or 15 feet off the ground. I looked down and was clutched by this fear. And I felt this sense that, you know, this thing, this cautiousness had been growing in me. And I hadn't really noticed it happening over the years. And I didn't want it. I don't want to lose that tree climber's spirit that you have when you're a child.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went and I took a tree climbing class. I went to England and I found myself a tree climber who makes videos online. His name is Ben Atkinson. And he makes these beautiful videos of himself climbing out onto the branches of trees, kind of tiptoeing way out to the edge of the tree, out to the outer branch, and then he'll jump from one branch to another. And he'll walk around, and it was very dance-like. And so I flew to England, and I traveled up to the Lake District, and I spent a couple of days with Ben climbing around in the branches of trees. And, you know, he taught me a lot of lessons about how to manage fear and how to stay branchy.
What was it like to when you get to the crown of your first big tree? How did you feel?
Well, first of all, you feel afraid, of course, and nervous. I mean, Ben was very comfortable up there, and I was not. My leg was shaking. You know, I think they call it sewing machine leg. And and then Ben did something interesting. He said, "I'm going to poke you in the chest, and you swat my hand away." So we're up there teetering, you know, maybe, I don't know, 10, 12 feet off the ground, high enough that if you fell, you'd probably, you know, break an ankle or something. And when you reach out to touch my chest, I swatted it away a few times, not hard. He wasn't trying to, you know, make me fall. And then he said, "Look down at your leg. That your leg has stopped shaking." And what he meant was, you know, that your body knows how to do all this. It's our mind that gets in the way. So that was the first lesson. Sort of just, he says, get off the neurotic merry-go-round. You know, don't overthink things. Just focus on your body. Just be in your body. And when you do, there were a couple of moments up there when I felt a real sense of clarity. And I think this is probably what rock climbers feel, free solo rock climbers especially, like Alex Honnold, that sense of tremendous clarity and present tense awareness. But, of course, being a writer, I'm, you know, sort of neurotically aware of everything I'm experiencing. So then I started overthinking how aware I was being, and then I would lose that sense of clarity. The last thing that I felt was a sort of gratefulness, you know, a feeling of being held. I mean, I don't know if you felt this as a kid climbing trees, but you get this sense that you're in the arms of a much larger and older being. You know, the tree is quite literally holding you there in its hands. And I think if a lot of us held on to that feeling, that feeling of both precariousness and gratitude, our environmental philosophy, our treatment of the earth would be a lot healthier.
Now, it doesn't stop there, and there's a lot of other adventures, including climbing the giant redwoods with Steen Christensen. And at one point, that has to have been an amazing. I've been and I've seen these trees on the Pacific Coast, and just standing at the bottom of them, I was in a weird kind of awe that I've never had before, because they're just so freaking huge, and the smell is weird and everything else. What did you experience when you first came up to some of these giants?
Well, that was an extraordinary experience and really an extraordinary privilege. So as you say, I have this friend named Steen Christensen. He's a cone collector. He climbs trees with ropes to collect various kinds of cones to plant them and grow them. And he'd invited me to come work on a David Attenborough documentary for the BBC that was being filmed in Sequoia National Park. So normally, you don't get to just go climb the trees in Sequoia National Park with ropes. But because Steen and I had both learned the art of technical tree climbing, we got to kind of sneak in and be part of the ropes team. And so, first of all, that was an extraordinary experience to see how those documentaries are made. But the most extraordinary thing was to get to climb some of these 250-foot tall giants. You know, the sequoias are the largest trees on Earth by mass. They have these enormous trunks. And what's most remarkable about them to me is not just the size, but the presence of them. They have a sort of animal presence, what I call it, creatureliness. You walk up to them, and you press your hands into their bark, and it feels almost like fur. They feel to me more obviously alive than other trees for some reason. And I'm sure that has something to do with me being an animal and sort of, you know, seeing a resemblance there. But also just the grandness. I mean, they really are the most awe-inspiring trees on Earth, in my opinion. And as I write in the book, they're really a foundational moment in environmental history, in American environmental history, was when settlers first encountered the giant sequoias. And the thought of cutting these trees down, ancient giants, felt so sacrilegious that it actually broke the logic of the logging industry for the first time in American history. And people said, okay, we need to set these aside. We can't just, you know, cut them down. And there's a great moment in congressional history when a senator named John Conness says, we need to set this aside. What later became Yosemite National Park and the Mariposa Grove of sequoias. And they said to him, well, there's no precedent for that. Why would we set aside trees just to do nothing, you know? There's no economic reason for that. And he said, there is no precedent and can be no precedent because there are no other trees on Earth like them.
What was it like to get at the top, though? I mean, as you write in the book, these trees are so huge that there's an entire ecology of the canopy.
Yeah, one of the
people don't realize that.
It's amazing. I mean, they actually change. But both I've climbed both coast redwoods and giant sequoias, and they both change as you climb from the bottom to the top. So the texture of the bark changes. It gets a lot thinner as you get to the top and kind of drier, less furry. And the needles change. The needles at the bottom are very broad and open, especially in the coast redwoods. And then they kind of close up. They tighten up as they get toward the top. And in coast redwoods, they can actually drink in moisture through their needles. They've learned to do that. They drink the fog so that they don't have to hoist it all the way up from the roots, which is a lot of work. But what you mostly learn up there is that, yeah, there's an entire world up there. There's an entire ecology. There are a number of scientists who started studying the forest canopy, and they found that there's amazing biodiversity up there, especially insects, of course. But there are all sorts of other species. If you climb to the top of a coast redwood, you'll find berry bushes up there. You'll find all sorts of aquatic animals.
Well, one of the alcid.
Salamanders.
Salamanders.
That's right. Salamanders. But what I found what was most interesting to me was I climbed this one coast redwood with a bonsai artist, and we found a tiny bonsai tree, a tiny natural bonsai, a tan oak that was, I think, 30 years old. It was about a foot tall, growing in a tiny pocket of dirt up there. There's like a tree growing atop another tree.
And I want to mention, for the benefit of the audience, there's a whole section on bonsai, which is so weird to follow that with climbing these giants. But and that's another whole story. I want to make sure that we talk about the last several chapters of the book, because you participate in protests, the pipeline blockade and the tree sitting at Ferry Creek. And that seems to have changed your life. Am I right in saying that?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I've been a journalist, a working journalist, since basically I graduated from college. It's been almost 20 years now. And, you know, I often work in the field of environmental journalism, and I'm often trying to, I mean, I think, you know, promote stories, tell stories that are on the right side of history when it comes to saving our environment. But there's a kind of line that you don't cross. You know, you don't cross the line into activism. And then one day I was reporting from this pipeline blockade. They're building a tar sands pipeline, tripling the size of this tar sands pipeline called the TMX pipeline that runs from Alberta to British Columbia, where I live. And I was sitting up in this tree. They built a tree house, and the tree house was protecting a tree, and the tree was stopping the pipeline. And in the top of the tree house was this guy named Tim Takaro, who was kind of the leader of the blockade. And we talked for about an hour, and I was dangling from, maybe it was more than an hour, may have been an hour and a half, may have been 2 hours. You sort of lose track of time over there. But I was dangling from my arborist harness, which is a sort of tree climbing. They call it a saddle. It's very padded and very comfortable. And at one point he said to me, how are you doing that? Because they were all using rock climbing harnesses, which are a lot less comfortable and frankly a lot less safe, because they can give you blood clots if you hang for too long. And I started to look around and notice that they were doing things in these ways that seemed to me kind of reckless. They were actually climbing out on fishing ropes rather than climbing ropes between trees, and doing all these kind of wild things. And I thought, well, I have a skill set. I mean, at that point, I'd been climbing trees with ropes for many years, working on this book. And not only do I have a skill set climbing trees, but I have a skill set as a writer that I can help promote this pipeline protest. I can be away from home for a long time. I can sit in a tree for a long time. I can do all these things a lot of people can't do. And I thought, why am I sitting here interviewing this guy and not sitting where he's sitting?
Right.
And because he was saying, look, we need people. We need people to man this treehouse. And so I said, you know what? Oh, fine. I'm gonna join this blockade. I'm finally going to do something about the climate crisis, which I've been feeling this sense of urgency and this sense of helplessness about for many years. And so I did. I joined in. I started putting in stints in the treehouse of about 5 days at a time. I think I put in 7 stints in total, so more than a month where I was living in the treehouse, blockading this pipeline until it all came sort of dramatically crashing down there at the end.
But you also started thinking about the fact that we need a new environmental movement with a different perspective.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think that realization came primarily from talking with First Nations people here in Canada, where I live, Indigenous people. I started to think about the idea of rootedness, of being rooted to place, deeply rooted, not rooted in the sort of shallow sense of ethno-nationalism, which I think is a sort of counterfeit form of rootedness, but rooted to your local ecology, your local community of life, in a way that reaches into every aspect of your life and language and lore in the way that First Nations people are. And when I started talking to people about their worldview, and it was so deeply rooted, it made me realize how unrooted mine was. And I had seen glimmers of this in the past while working on trails. I'd spoken with Cherokee people and Navajo people, and again, I'd seen this deep, deep attachment to place. And I've never really had that. You know, I'm from the States and I live in Canada. My parents are from Texas, but, you know, they'd moved to Illinois. Now they don't even live in Illinois anymore. Mom lives in Mexico, and my husband is from Australia, and we all just sort of float around. And I thought that was normal, you know, to have basically no attachment to place. And I realize now, I think that it's actually a big hole in our personal and spiritual lives to have no sense of rootedness. And it has really grievous effects for the environment. If you think about what a traditional Indigenous person would have to know about their environment just to survive, the really deep relationships they would have with all the various local species and with their local community to stay alive, it makes you we are missing, because our lives come often kind of prepackaged, right? We just buy food off the shelf. We don't need those deep relationships, and it allows us to have these very abstract, very over-intellectualized, but also very extractive relationships with nature. And so I think that by trying to find that sense of rootedness and what philosophers call relationality, find our way back to a relational worldview, I think that a lot of these sort of second and third order problems that we see with our relationship with the environment will start to heal.
It's an amazing bit of writing there in this last several chapters. There were words that come up throughout the book, like dikost.
Yeah, dikost.
Dikost, which is a Russian word. We only have a minute or two left, but can you define that?
Sure, yeah. It's a funny word to define because they have a word for it in English. It means a kind of wildness or ecstasy.
Yeah.
It's a kind of distinctly Russian word, but it's sort of marching to the beat of your own drummer. And one of the quintessential examples of dikost, I think, is the great Russian author Leo Tolstoy.
Oh yeah,
who I love. I've read much of his work, not all, but he has a vast corpus of later works that I haven't read. But when you read his life history, it's just full of these moments of wildness, including at one point getting in a fight with a bear, which left him with a scar across his face, which of course then he would then tell the story of it at cocktail parties and various events throughout his life.
So
that wildness, he was always trying everything, they said, even gymnastics, and he learned to ride a bike when he was in his 70s, and he was playing tennis and swimming in the ICC and doing all of these things that
get branchy.
People around him were telling him not to do anymore. They're saying, you're too old for that.
Ah.
And he refused to listen to them.
We're going to end it right there because we're out of time. We could talk about this book for hours. Trust me, so you need to read it. Care About the Fate of Those Who Will Outlive You. And that's one of the final words and thoughts in the book. My guest tonight has been Robert Moore, writer, activist, philosopher. And we're talking about his latest book. It's a really interesting read. In Trees, An Exploration. Robert, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. It's been a great conversation.
And thanks for writing this book. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.